from the speech of Donald Trump to a grandmother who started writing children's stories. Yeah, all coming your way live from Israel.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, friends, we are coming your way again live from Israel. Still in the Galilee. In fact, we had the amazing time of doing water baptisms in the River Jordan. Yet there's something special about it. Just an awesome experience together with many on our tour group being immersed in water today. And tomorrow, God willing, we'll be doing Thoroughly Jewish Thursday from Jerusalem. But today, we want to focus on the speech to Congress of President Donald Trump. And according to one conservative pundit, John Potteritz, he said, in the first 38 days of his presidency, Donald Trump seemed to struggle to find his footing. On his 39th, he found it unexpectedly in a strong, direct, and surprise of surprises, beautifully modulated and spectacularly delivered address before Congress. Fox commentator Chris Wallace said this is the day he became president, and some fascinating comments even from critics. What's your take? I didn't watch the speech live. I was here in Israel, so we're 7 hours ahead, but I read the entire transcript. I wrote an article about, please don't tell me that Donald Trump's speech was racist. You can read that at thelineoffire.org. What was your take? If you watched the speech, maybe you've been critical of Donald Trump in the past. Maybe you've written him off. Maybe you think he's a buffoon. Did the speech change your thinking last night? Maybe you have been praying for Donald Trump and you voted for him, but you've wanted him to be more presidential. Did he hit that note last night? Are you still skeptical? Are you excited? 866-348-7884 is the number to call. That is, as always, 866-34-TRUTH. I want to play one clip for you, though, from Van Jones, JJ clip number 15. Van Jones is very much left-leaning CNN commentator. He said many make exception to over the years, quotes I've seen, interaction he had with others. And barely. Listen to what he had to say in terms of Donald Trump's speech last night.
He became president of the United States.
It looks like
in that moment, period. There are a lot of people who have a lot of reason to be frustrated with him, to be fearful of him, to be mad at him. But that was one of the most extraordinary moments you have ever seen in American politics, period.
Van Jones is speaking specifically about the moment when President Trump honored the widow of a slain Navy SEAL officer. And the applause was exceptional, sustained for a couple of minutes. Just watching the video on YouTube of the different segments of that, it was very, very intense. That's the moment Van Jones is speaking of. And Van Jones basically said if Donald Trump keeps doing this, that he's going to be the president for the next 8 years. And what's also evident is the lack of Democratic leadership. In fact, some of the more extreme Democrats not even standing to honor the widow of the Navy SEAL, which is all the more extraordinary, or not standing when he said that we will work to destroy radical Islamic terrorism, which he specifically said, radical Islamic terrorism, which he specifically said kills Muslims as well as Christians. So we'll interact on that. We'll get your take, 866-348-7884. And we come back. I want to encourage your heart, whoever you are, wherever you are, that God might have something exciting, new, and unexpected in the journey ahead for you. We'll be right back. Much more to come live from Israel. Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we are here live in Israel. And with the shofar blast right here in our makeshift studio at the Galilee Experience. If you're ever in Tiberias, make sure you visit the Galilee Experience. We're going to talk to you about the president's speech to Congress last night to weigh in, 866-348-7884, how you felt about the speech. If you've been critical, if you've been positive, I'd love to get your take. Before we do that, though, I've got a special guest with me, a friend for many years. Adult children went to our ministry school years ago. So we've known the family for many years from now living in Barbados, Roberta Simpson. And Roberta's married to a very successful businessman. She's done different kinds of ministry over the years, but more, you know, internal and in a friendship level, things like that. And somehow something interesting happened a few years back, about 8 years back. Roberta, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Mike. It's wonderful to be here.
All right. So you basically set in life, having a blessed life and yes, getting to minister to many people and all state, you know, and enjoying your family. Time to slow down. You're in your early 70s and grandmother. And what happened?
Well, I've always been a storyteller. Even when my five kids were little, I loved telling stories. And one day I was challenged because I was babysitting someone's child. No, sorry, I was babysitting one of my grandchildren. And Kiffin's secretary said to me the next day.
So your husband's secretary, yeah.
Yes, myself, yes. What crazy story did you tell your grandchildren last night? And I said, well, actually, a Bible story. And it was Jesus and the little lost lamb. And she said, why don't you write the stories down? Why don't you write a book? I said, been there, done that, never doing it again. I was so rude to her because I went to a writer's seminar years before that, and they told me I couldn't write.
Really?
Scribbled up all my pages in red ink, and I was still hurting from that. And I was so rude to this poor woman, and I got in my car and I left. And as soon as I turned onto the highway, if God ever spoke to me, he said, you can now write.
Whoa. And you were 72 at that point.
Yes.
And no writing experience. The only writing experience got trashed.
Yes. And I used to write letters to the paper sometimes about Israel and, you know, trying to combat what other people had written. Anyway, I went home and I got on my computer and I wrote my first story. And my grandson, Rafi, is very upset because I use my grandchildren's names in all the stories. So he was the little lost lamb.
Oh.
And it was his favorite story when he was little. And he said, Nan, please tell me the story of Jesus and the Yittul Yost Yam, because he couldn't pronounce his L's. And so all the other grandchildren are people, and he's a sheep. So that's a joke. But Steve Hill, of course, you know him. He was my critic, and he encouraged me and read my stories before they were published. And all of a sudden, I had a book out there called Nana's Bible Stories.
And what happened with it?
Well, it did extremely well. I had a whole new life. I went on TV. I went on radio.
And this started in your 70s.
In 72,
right.
Yeah.
Got it.
And it's been a really wild, exciting, adventurous time. It is amazing. I feel like telling grandmothers all over the world, get up and do something because God has a plan for you. I mean, Moses was 80.
Yeah.
You know, why are we so afraid of age? Yeah. I just was 80, and
And here you are on the Israel
God.
Tour.
Yes.
Walking thousands of steps,
yes,
every day.
Actually, the first day I did 11,000 steps.
Uh-huh.
So I told one of my grandsons, he says, Nan, you're coming home skinny. But I wish.
Well, good food. Good food on the tours.
Yes.
That's kind of balances that out. So we gave It was one or two. What was the second book you wrote?
The second book was Once Upon a Christmas, and then the third, Tales from the Ark.
Got it.
But the first book sold about 55,000 copies, which
Seriously.
Is not too bad for someone who can't write.
Amazing. Amazing. And that means that because kids don't know to buy it, so parents had to find out about it, and then the kids had to like it, and then
yes.
it spreads by word of mouth. Because you can be on TV and do whatever. If it's not good, it doesn't spread.
No.
And yeah, we sampled it out. Our youngest granddaughter is 10 now, so I think she was 8 when you sent the books about 2 years ago. I think it may have been the first and the third.
Okay.
And I remember we sent you a picture of her with all of her stuffed toys in bed reading the book. And
yes.
she was really enjoying
it. It was fun. It was sweet, yes.
So what is it? I find it much easier to reach, so maybe to debate a rabbi and be challenged by some agnostic professor than to answer questions from little kids, because their questions are often so piercing,
oh my goodness,
penetrating.
Yes.
What have you learned about communicating with little kids, something that gets them in, that connects spiritually?
Well, there's been a couple of things, which is really neat. And one, to remark on your first statement, kids do ask the craziest things. And at my first launch, never had a launch, well, the first one in Barbados, they wanted me to read Balaam and the Donkey story.
Uh-huh.
So then it was all televised for our television, and one of the people in charge said, okay, now it's time that you can ask Nana, because everyone calls me Nana, questions. And I nearly died. I thought, oh my gosh. So the questions were easy, but this one little girl got up and said, do you think he was the same donkey that Jesus rode into Jerusalem? And I nearly panicked, because I thought, I can't put this child down.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can't make her feel bad. So I'm telling you, the Lord is so good, because he cared for that child. And right away, something came to my mind, and it was, well, no, I don't think it could have been, but it may have been related.
Ah.
They might have been, you know, some family connection.
Uh-huh.
And she was as happy as a lark with that.
That works.
It works. And it just shows me that we can't panic. God is able to put something in our heart and mind. And then because of the books, I get invited to the schools a lot.
Really?
To speak, to share. And there was this one school that there was one little boy. I hope I don't cry, but somehow the Lord put him on my heart. And for the last couple of years, that was my favorite school, and I would go there. And as a result, I have got in touch with his family, seen where he lives. When I saw where he lived, I couldn't sleep that night, because I thought no one should live in a place like that.
Mm.
But now I'm doing a fright when I can. I said to the Lord very religiously, you know, Lord, where can I get this family to church? And he said, you go and be the church.
Mm.
So whenever I can, I go down there. I love on them. I bring groceries. I bring, you know, some chicken and pizza and stuff. We have a party, and they bring out my Bible story books, and I tell them a story. But I engage them as well. You know, I get them to make remarks and also tell me a story.
Mm. So Roberta, if you could speak to folks who are older or retired, or others who just think, I'm too average, I God can't use me, why do you believe that God could use anybody that yields to them?
Well, I believe that he has a plan. It doesn't matter what age. I mean, I just pray I can serve God in whatever capacity till it's time for me to leave this earth. But everybody has something they like to do. I love telling stories.
Mm.
I never thought I could write them. And I'm sure people listening, they can cook. They know how to pray. They know how to be kind to people. I mean, go in the supermarket and see someone that looks miserable. Just go and smile at them and say, God loves you, or something. There's something we can all do. And very often it's right there in front of us. We don't see it because we think it's too simple.
Mm, that's something to consider. And what's been your greatest reward? Obviously, it's great to know the numbers of books sold, but that's very secondary. You never did this for money. What's been your greatest reward in all this?
I just think going into the schools, telling them a Bible story, asking them if they'd like to ask Jesus into their hearts, praying with them. I mean, I remember one. Remember when Steve Hill died? Mm-hmm. He was such an encourager to me.
Yeah.
He would call me up and say, "Hi, sis, what are you doing?" "I'm at the hairdresser." "You can write while you're under the dryer." I'd say, "Steve, women don't sit under dryers anymore." But, you know, Steve had died, and I was thinking of that scripture, "We're encompassed by a cloud of witnesses." And I'm standing there, and I'm telling them the story, and I heard Steve's voice, "Go for it. You may never have that opportunity again." 250 kids gave their hearts.
All right, friends, here's an 80-year-old daughter of God from Israel saying to each of you, it's God's voice, go for it.
Fire we want, for fire we
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. We are live in Israel. Woo! Having an awesome time. And before I get into, I just wanted to take a minute with Roberta. She just went back to the hotel about 10-15 minutes from where we're broadcasting, but she has such an amazing story. 80 years old, full of life and vibrant. You'd never believe she's 80 if you saw her and talked to her. But while we had her around, I wanted her to share her story with you, and I hope it brought encouragement and faith to you, and maybe God spoke to some of you directly in terms of what you can do, how your life can be used to make a difference, whoever you are, wherever you are. Before we get back to the speech of Donald Trump, I want to speak to some of the folks that are in studio with me that were baptized today. Now, we normally associate baptism in the New Testament sense with a once-for-all public act, dying to sin, rising a new life in the Messiah, a public act of repentance and faith. And it's of great significance in the life of a believer and something commanded that should be one of the very first things that happens in the life of a new believer. But we also recognize that immersion had different purposes in biblical times. There was the concept of repentance and dedication of life. A religious Jew would be immersed on a daily basis or a weekly basis for cleansing purposes and things like that. So we welcome folks to be immersed that wanted to make a fresh dedication of their lives, not the once-for-all baptism, but a fresh dedication, and some who had never been immersed before. And we did it in the River Jordan. And when people wanted to do it in our first tour a few years back, 2014, I was like, I don't know, that's like a little hokey. And I tell you, once we got to do it, the presence of the Lord and the reality of God and what he was doing was very precious and very powerful. And I said, absolutely, we'll do it again. So we had a good number immersed today. And I looked them in the eyes and established their confession of faith and asked them if they were willing to follow the Lord, regardless of cost or consequence, whether by life or death, and wonderful responses, many with tears. So I just want to hear from a few that if you were immersed in water today, we got a couple of guys that have been on the air regularly here and so far this week. But anybody else that was baptized today, that my back is to you, so you need to come over where I am, all right? And I just want to find out the significance, what happened, and come on, man. All right, do it. Yes, whoever's here, come on. All right, and just tell me, you were immersed, and your son as well. How old's your son?
He's 11.
All right. Did he say what significance it had? Did you guys talk about it afterwards at all?
We haven't really had a chance to, no.
Now, could you see anything in terms of his seriousness doing it as you were there, as he was being baptized?
Our family has already paid a dear cost for the sake of the gospel, and so I know that following Jesus means a lot to him. Mm. So, yeah.
Well, the tears in your eyes say more than the words. Obviously, there's a story there. And for you, when I asked you and looked in your eyes, are you willing to follow him regardless of cost or consequence, whether by life or death? And many were just saying the words back to me, whether by life or death. And it's reality. I mean, we've immersed people that have given their lives for the gospel or laid hands on them and sent them out in different parts of the world. But what did it mean for you today to do that in the River Jordan?
You know, it was a renewing of the confession and the commitment that I have to Jesus. And I just want to tell you, this is not really related to the baptism, but my heart has just been breaking for the people of Israel as I've been here and gotten to know them. And I see them, and they're just such a wonderful people. These are people with, you know, faces like gold and hands of leather and backbones of steel. They're some of the nicest people that you've ever met. They're not all rich. They're not all typical like what we think of Jewish people or Israelis. Or they're wonderful people. And my heart's just breaking for them. And this baptism helped renew the commitment that I have to Jesus and to seek and to save the lost. To see many people standing in that place where I was being baptized and confessing their love for Jesus.
Yeah, awesome. There is that sense of identification. And, you know, for me, I was just thinking that every congregation on the planet on a regular basis should be immersing new converts. That it is life. It is what God intended. And when you have long lines of people that are all brand new and family members, it's just, that's what it's all about. Let's hear from a couple others. If you were baptized today, just the significance. And we had a husband and wife that were baptized. Hang on. You can tell us, for your wife, was there anything? Did you guys get to talk about significance?
You know, this whole trip has been significant. When we were back in Alaska and we were preparing for this trip, we were just really expecting God to do amazing things. We're just at this season in our life. We're just craving more. So when we came on this trip, we just told each other and committed to each other that we were going to just do everything that we could possibly do. We want to, you know, stay up late and soak every ounce of this trip up, including getting baptized again. We both have been baptized, but we knew that there's just something special about being here in Israel. And I guess, you know, if anything, just driving through the towns, being there at the Jordan River, just all of a sudden your faith comes so real with the Bible stories. It's like everything is clicking. Even just being there and you're picturing John the Baptist, you're picturing Jesus, and you're all of a sudden you're like, this is me. I'm here. Like, I can't believe this. So if anything, it was, you know, like my brother said, it's just that renewal. But, you know, we just want all that God has for us. And so I know for both Karis and I, like, it was definitely an epic moment.
Awesome. Epic. That's the way to describe it. All right. One more. Some of these voices, if you've been listening each week, or listening every day this week, you've heard the same. And anybody else that was baptized that's here? Okay, great. Well listen, again, if you've never gone to Israel, pray about it. The impact is dramatic, and it's the lasting impact. A lot happens in a week. In the course of a day, enough happens that you have to take it all in because it's stuff you've never seen and never experienced, and it's just reality. And it's not a political thing. It's not Israel versus Palestine. No, it's a spiritual thing. It's a biblical thing. But things will be written on your heart dramatically and supernaturally. So we encourage you to pray about going. I've been encouraged to take tours regularly. We'll see. This is only the second that we've done, and I've been coming to Israel since 1986. This is only the second time we've done a tour here, so in 30 years. But it's worth it to see the incredible impact on lives and people touched. And join me in praying for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. God does not have another way for Jews to be saved outside of Yeshua. God does not have a separate covenant with Israel outside of the blood of the slain lamb. So pray for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And God willing, tomorrow we get over to Jerusalem, and then we're head to Jerusalem, and then we have time right through the weekend there. And there we're surrounded by many more religious Jews, and you're reminded so many so near and yet so far. So we'll be praying. We're going to be talking about the Trump speech next. But if you join us this week, if you stand with us this week as a monthly supporter, as a torchbearer, we have a special Jewish ministry package we put together that'll really minister to you. Some great resources we want to get in your hands as our thank you, equipping gift. When you join us as a torchbearer this month, go to lineoffire.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Save the nation. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
For people who have been hoping that he would become unifying, hoping that he might find some way to become presidential, they should be happy with that moment. For people who have been hoping that maybe he would remain a divisive cartoon, which he often finds a way to do, they should begin to become a little bit worried tonight. Because that thing you just saw him do, if he finds a way to do that over and over again, he's going to be there for 8 years. Now, there is a lot that he said in that speech that was counterfactual, that was not right, that I oppose and will oppose. But he did something tonight that you cannot take away from him. He became president of the United States.
Again, that is Van Jones, extremely left-leaning CNN commentator, actually former communist, as I understand it, and yet had to praise Donald Trump and said, look, if you're against him, and you may have to look again, because if he keeps doing this, he'll be here for 8 years. That's significant. That's significant. And I tweeted out this question, I guess it was the middle of the night, stateside time, and whenever I out in Israel, a simple poll, and it just asked this, because Donald Trump said this in towards the end of his speech to Congress, the time for trivial fights is behind us. And I said, do you expect to see a change in his own behavior in the days ahead? Because look, there are trivial fights that the media is picking, and there are trivial fights that President Trump has been picking. So I asked, do you expect to see a change in his own behavior in the days ahead? And the first votes in, almost 700 so far, 31% said yes, 48% said no, 21% said unsure. So obviously not a lot of clarity in terms of what people are expecting. I expect Donald Trump to be Donald Trump. I do expect that, but, and point of fact, I expect him, and at least am praying that he would become more and more presidential in the process. Major on the majors. If he's going to be a wrecking ball, let him be a wrecking ball on the things that matter. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to Tony in Logan County, West Virginia. Thanks for calling the line of fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. We appreciate your ministry and so glad to be able to talk to you.
Sure thing, sir. Go ahead.
I listened to Trump's speech, and I think Van Jones, though I've probably never agreed with him before, I probably agree with him now.
Uh-huh. Now, what was your take on President Trump before? Did you vote for him? Were you a supporter?
I was not a supporter. I did vote for him eventually after great consternation and debate within my own heart. It was a struggle, but in the end, it was more a vote against Hillary as a vote for Trump. But I've been very pleased with what he's done so far. I think the speech was very presidential and very. I think starting out with some racial recognition and trying to bridge that gap, and even mentioning some of the anti-Semitism that's been rearing its ugly head. I think all that's been very positive what came out of the speech.
Yeah, and Tony, I mirror your sentiments. Really struggled with voting for Donald Trump, and then felt I should, and also wanted to vote against Hillary Clinton. And yeah, the comments, the breaking of the race gap, seeking to do that, and the anti-Semitism issues, to put those right at the front, that was noticeable. He was sending a message. In fact, I want to pick up there when we come back. So if you did listen to last night's speech, you can be critical. You can call in. You can say while you're still skeptical. That is perfectly fine. But, by all means, let's talk. And we should be praying for President Trump. And if he does well, you should be glad. It's good when our president does well.
Flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Oh yeah, we are in the land where this is the native language, coming your way live from Israel. Here we are. All right, you hear the faint shofar blast in the back, but I want you to know that's a whole lot better than I can actually blow the shofar. 866-348-7884. Let's just listen to a little bit of the speech from Donald Trump last night, clip number 9.
As promised, I directed the Department of Defense to develop a plan to demolish and destroy ISIS, a network of lawless savages that have slaughtered Muslims and Christians and men and women and children of all faiths and all beliefs. We will work with our allies, including our friends and allies in the Muslim world, to extinguish this vile enemy from our planet.
All right, that was something I was very glad to hear. Again, just as in the inaugural speech, President Trump making reference to radical Islamic terrorism. Why is it important to mention? If you don't mention it, you cannot deal with it. You cannot effectively deal with an ideology. You're not just dealing with a military enemy. You're dealing with an ideology. You're dealing with the fact that many folks have gotten involved in terrorism. Say the train bombings, the British equivalent of 9/11 several years back. The train bombings, they were perpetrated largely by second-generation Muslims. They had lived in England. They had been raised in England. They were privileged to live in England, and yet they were engaged in these terrorist acts. Others have become radicalized over a period of years. They arrived in another country, and they weren't radicalized, but they became radicalized. So you've got to deal with the ideology. Then you have to understand how it works and how it mobilizes people and how it gets people to give their blood if you're going to effectively deal with it. But look, this is as clear as you can make it when you, number one, use qualifying terms. You don't just say Muslims. You don't just say Muslim terrorists. You say radical Islamic terrorism. You are separating that from Islam as a whole. Now, some say, well, all Muslims are terrorists. And others say, well, no true Muslim is a terrorist. The truth is in between. There are Muslims, devoted Muslims, who are terrorists. And the majority of the Muslim world is not terrorist. But you make that distinction, and then you clearly say that these radical Islamic terrorists, ISIS, these radical Islamic terrorists have what? They have killed Muslims and Christians and people of all faiths, and Donald Trump will work with the rest of the Muslim world, friends and allies we have in the Muslim world, to blot out ISIS and to blot out other radical Islamic terrorists, Al-Qaeda and Taliban and others like that. So it is true that the number one victim in terms of the people who have the least defense, the people who are caught between a rock and a hard place, the people who are in the greatest difficulty in Muslim countries where there's civil wars and uprisings, the Christians. The Christians, without a doubt, suffer persecution in the most ferocious and direct way and are often not welcome on either side. If you've got a war between Sunni and Shia and all these things going on, you're always the odd man out, and you've got the least defense, and somehow the world not even standing for you. You're not even safe in refugee camps, which is one reason that many Christians don't make it out of their country. They have to just flee. They don't get formally resettled because they're not even safe in refugee camps. That's one reason for it. But that being said, the largest number of people who are killed by Islamic terrorists are other Muslims. Muslims killing Muslims. This is happening all the time. And Sunnis bombing Shiite funerals and Shiites bombing Sunni mosque services. Happening all the time. So President Trump is right to single this out. And yet, to make clear that this is not a war on Islam. It's not a war on Muslims. This is a war on radical Islamic terrorism, which kills Muslims as well as Christians. And he's calling on the Muslim world, friends and allies in the Muslim world, like Egypt, for example, and saying, let's work together to eradicate this, because this is a common enemy in many Muslim countries. So when Donald Trump was campaigning and now is president, he is constantly charged with being a racist, xenophobic, hyper-nationalistic. The whole alt-right movement, which is equated with white supremacists. And look, you had the KKK and these other white supremacists cheering them on. That's true. They also endorsed and voted for Ronald Reagan. That doesn't mean that Reagan was a white supremacist. But there is a strong nationalism, America first, that can be healthy and wonderful and good, because as a country, you have to care for your own needs. And then as you care for your own needs, you can help the rest of the world. It's like when you're flying, if you've ever heard the instructions that if the oxygen masks come down for some reason, if you're flying with a child, what are you supposed to do? Care for the child first. No. Put the mask on yourself first and then care for the child. This way, when you're breathing properly, you can care properly for your child. Otherwise, you may never get the mask on your kid at all, and you're not going to be there to help them. So it's fine to say America first in the sense of, yeah, you got to protect your country and your borders and trade interests and for the good of the country. But if America is strong, it can strengthen and be a blessing to the rest of the world. There's another America first mentality, which is xenophobic, which is hyper-nationalistic, which is dangerously to the right, and which could look to some type of dictator to just take over and lead the way and crush all resistance. But I don't believe that's who Donald Trump is. And I believe that that extreme right represents the minority of those following him. And even in my most critical days of candidate Trump during the Republican primary, you can read articles I wrote raising concerns about him. You can listen to radio broadcasts. You can watch videos. So I've been candid about all that. Once he won the nomination, I said, hey, I'm rooting for him. I want you to know I'm rooting for him. I hope that the warnings and the concerns I had are wrong. That was my hope. That was my desire. So my desire is not to say, hey, I was right. My desire was to have our country blessed and to have a good president, to say, hey, looks like my warnings, my concerns were overdone, that God was doing something beyond what I saw. Maybe the warnings were valid, but they're being addressed as Donald Trump is growing into this role as our president. But even in my most critical days, I didn't see him as a racist. I saw him making insensitive comments, unwise comments, but I didn't think he was a racist, and I certainly felt confident he wasn't an anti-Semite. And I addressed that in my latest article, which you can read on thelineoffire.org. So starting with Black Americans, after just, you know, ladies and gentlemen, kind of opening, what's his very first sentence? First sentence in the speech. Tonight, as we mark the conclusion of our celebration of Black History Month, we are reminded of our nation's path towards civil rights and the work that still remains. That's how he starts. The opening words. And I just want to focus on Black Americans for a moment here, all right? Because obviously, the vast majority of African Americans voted democratically, as they have, even more so for Barack Obama, but as they had previously for Bill Clinton, as they had previously for those that were running against George Bush. Just like the vast majority of Jews vote Democrat, the vast majority, even higher percentage, of Black Americans vote Democrat. And a large percentage of Hispanic Americans vote Democrat. So no surprise here. And then Donald Trump has been painted as a racist. But friends of mine that have spent time with him told me that he really is concerned about the inner city. He really is concerned about the plight of Black Americans in the inner city, and that his reaching out is genuine, genuine. So he says this: we financed and built one global project after another, but ignored the fates of our children in the inner cities of Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit, and so many other places throughout our land. Now, is this only a Black American issue, inner city, Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit? No. But I say, he's saying, look, we've helped people around the world, but we haven't helped our own. And certainly, that means African Americans are right in his radar, saying we need to do something to help right here. This is a national problem. This is our problem. And he says, our neglected inner cities will see a rebirth of hope, safety, and opportunity. When he said 94 million Americans are out of the labor force and over 43 million people are now living in poverty and over 43 million Americans are on food stamps, disproportionately, that does apply to African Americans. That because of our system and other issues and history, whatever it is that's gone on, that there's a disproportionately high number out of the workforce and living in poverty. So even though he didn't mention Black Americans there, I take that as him reaching out again in that way as well. Then he singles out a Black American woman, Denisha Merriweather, as an example of the merit of private schools, calling her, quote, a remarkable woman noting that she was the first in her family to graduate from college, soon to get her master's degree, and then stating, "We want all children to be able to break the cycle of poverty, just like Denisha." So it's one thing to talk stats and generalizations. It's another thing to talk specifically. It's another thing to talk about individuals and to single them out. You can only single out so many in the course of a speech like this. And then his first example of an American killed by an illegal immigrant, who was it? 17-year-old black man, Jameel Shaw Jr., quote, "incredible young man with unlimited potential. He was getting ready to go to college where he would have excelled as a great quarterback." He also honored Susan Oliver, a black woman whose husband Danny, a white man, was a policeman killed by an illegal immigrant. I say Donald Trump was sending a message to African-Americans saying, "I'm here for you."
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. We are coming your way live from the Galilee. Yeah, we'll have to do like each applause from each day because it's a long, full day, and we still have numbers of folks that are here with us. But at the end of each day, we're still getting good numbers coming out, and we're blessed by the time, and they're still energetic, still clapping, still energetic. Hey, I've got a special bonus. You're going to hear a mind-boggling story in a moment here, but before we get to that, Sebastian Gorka, who is a strategist, a White House foreign policy advisor working with Steve Bannon and always blasted by the left. But with Donald Trump saying last night, radical Islamic terrorism, his words, this is what he tweeted out yesterday. "After 8 years of obfuscation and disastrous counterterrorism policies, those three words are key to victory against global jihadism." Again, you cannot combat an enemy unless you name and understand the enemy. You cannot combat an ideology unless you explicitly identify that ideology, and that is part of the issue here. So I mentioned in the speech Donald Trump in particular reaching out to the African-American community loudly and clearly. You say, well, it's just words. Well, first, if he said nothing, or if he said things that were insensitive, you blast him for that. So if you're gonna blast him for bad words, then commend him for good words. All right. And then, like anything else, let's see what he actually delivers. Fine call. This is a call to say we're in this together. And this is him by making those the opening words of his speech and then conspicuous examples through his speech. He was sending a message there. Also to mention right at the outset, right at the beginning as well, to mention the vandalizing of Jewish cemeteries. Two events, vandalizing of cemeteries in two cities in the United States in a period of 1 week. So right up front, he references, quote, "recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries." And Matt, grab the clip, let JJ know. The clip where he mentions the new sanctions that he's imposing on those who support Iran's ballistic missile program. I want to play that as well. For those that think Donald Trump is an anti-Semite, again, remember that his daughter Ivanka converted to Judaism, is married to a Jewish man. That means their kids are Jewish, so he's got Jewish grandkids. I heard that all of his adult kids are either married to Jews or dating Jews. And I know nothing in his history that would indicate he's an anti-Semite. Living in New York, working with Jews for years and having a strong heart for Israel, talking about moving the embassy and things like that is anything but anti-Semitic. And an anti-Semite is not going to speak in these ways. And he also referenced, just in terms of civil rights, just in terms of combating any type of notion that he doesn't care about all Americans. Maybe he was insensitive in certain comments. He mentioned right up front last week's shooting in Kansas City. So here you have this in Kansas City, was a bar, a restaurant. There is a guy in there, a white American guy in there, and he's getting on these two Indians who are here. So presumably not Muslim, presumably not in Islamic garb. but Indians that were here, and he was getting on them, and another younger white guy went up to him and talked to him. Well, he comes back later with a gun, allegedly yells, "Get out of my country," before shooting. He kills one of the men, wounds the other. The other white guy is listening, counting bullets. He thinks he's out of ammunition, goes after him, and he gets shot himself and thankfully survives. So Donald Trump mentions this up front, and he mentions this in the context of civil rights. And then as far as immigration, so he's making clear, he's making clear, listen, I'm not declaring war on immigrants, all right? I'm declaring war on those that shouldn't be here that are destructive. So as for the immigrants he's deporting, he says this: we are removing gang members, drug dealers, and criminals that threaten our communities and prey on our citizens. Bad ones are going out as I speak tonight and as I have promised. President Obama, I believe in 2015, deported 43,000 illegal immigrants for various reasons. Was he being anti-immigrant or anti-Hispanic in doing so? Is Donald Trump being anti-Hispanic or anti-immigrant if he's removing gang members, drug dealers, and criminals that threaten our communities, prey on our citizens that are here illegally? Does anyone believe they should be here if they are seeking to destroy people's lives, kill people, engage in drug trafficking and human trafficking and other things like that? They're here illegally. If they're caught, of course they should be deported. And again, Donald Trump is saying, hey, we want to stand with peaceful Muslims around the world. We want to work together against radical Islamic terror. He even has a little bit of an olive branch to women. And obviously in the business world, he'd say, hey, everyone knows I've employed women in the high level in my company, etc. But he's obviously had his ugly statements about women in the past and been known as an insensitive playboy and so on. So here's a statement in the right direction. With the help of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, we formed a council with our neighbors in Canada to help ensure that women entrepreneurs have access to the networks, markets, and capital they need to start a business and live out their financial dreams. So listen, if you want to call Donald Trump a racist, I would just say, you better get your evidence in order and you better have your proof. And don't tell me about something 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. Let's look at the man today. What message is he sending out? Look, I was a strong critic of President Obama, but I kept hoping he would do things that I agreed with. And if he said something or did something I felt was praiseworthy, I would draw attention to it. An important line as I am in Israel right now. Let's listen to clip number 11 from President Trump's speech last night to Congress.
I have also imposed new sanctions on entities and individuals who support Iran's ballistic missile program and reaffirmed our unbreakable alliance with the State of Israel.
Let me say this. That's for the good of America. I'm sitting in Israel, and yes, in many ways, Israel needs America's help. And America's aid is critical for Israel. But I believe that America standing with Israel is more important for America than it is for Israel. I believe that America helping Israel doesn't mean destroying Palestinians or working against Palestinians or any such thing. What it means is recognizing our historic friendship, alliance with Israel, and recognizing the historic importance of Israel and the strategic importance of Israel, and hopefully the spiritual importance as well. It is for the good of America that we stand with Israel. And if President Trump does that, God will bless him for doing that. Hey, friends, in the second hour, we've got a great surprise. I was thinking as I was hearing this right before the show tonight, man, I got to get this brother on the air to share this story. And you're going to get to hear it by surprise. I just strolled into our studio here in the Galilee Experience in Galilee. So you can keep listening by going to thelineoffire.org. And when you join us as a torchbearer, as a monthly supporter, let me encourage you. We've got a wonderful package of Jewish resources to send your way. Do that at thelineoffire.org. My bottom line, President Trump is acting presidential. We're still live in the Galilee. We're focusing tonight on the speech of President Trump to Congress.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Gadol Elohai, shiru ki gadol Elohai, kol echad yireh ki gadol Elohai. Shem me'al kol shem, ata ra'ui le'alel, libi yashir ki gadol Elohai.
All right, I told you we've got a surprise. Maybe you've seen the viral YouTube video. What a gorgeous, blessed video of how great is our God, sung in Hebrew, in Israel. And the man singing it is sitting right next to me. That was not a tape playing. That was live sitting here. Joshua, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Shalom, what an honor.
Great to have you here. And how do you spell your last name?
A-A-R-O-N.
All right, like Aaron in the Bible. And what's happened? You have an amazing story, which I only heard tonight, minutes before the meeting. You came and did worship with the concert violinist Maurice Sklar, did some worship for our team. I had to leave right before you folks were done to come over to get ready for radio. But you told a story which is amazing, and we're going to tell it on the air together. But what happened with that video? Did you have a sense of God's hand on it as you were recording it?
Well, I heard the song. I love the song, How Great Is Our God. And my friends in Nashville call me J-Tom, the Jewish Chris Tomlin. Uh-huh. Sometimes I can't live it down ever since we did it. But I heard that song, and it was my favorite worship song years ago. And then they did the world version. And I remember sitting there listening to, I think it was Spanish, Russian, and a couple languages. And I was waiting for Hebrew.
Ah.
And as soon as the song, when I heard it for the first time, when it ended, I just felt this like mantle, like I need to sing this song in Hebrew. I feel like it's, at that point, was the most popular worship song. And to me, it was very special, just about the greatness of God. And I thought, we're living in the age where the nations have heard the gospel, almost all of them, and it's coming back here to Israel. And I thought it was important that I sang it in Hebrew.
Now, do you have other videos on YouTube?
Yes.
And how many would they be viewed on average up before this came out?
Oh, before that one? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was the song that started it all. Now I think now we have like 15 million views together of my songs.
Got it. So before that, it was just low thousands?
Yes.
Got
oh,
it.
Yes.
So
oh,
something
yes.
happened.
Something
this,
really did happen, yeah.
And what was your feeling? There's kind of a joyous community celebration feel as you watch it. How did you feel putting it together?
The song?
Yeah, as you recorded the video.
I mean, I was excited. I was really excited. People have already been singing it in Israel for years. So when I heard the world version, I was so excited to share it with the nations. And I knew everybody was going to love it. I didn't know how many people, but I know people who heard it were going to be drawn to the Hebrew, the idea that they're singing it in the language of the Bible.
All right, and your YouTube channel again is?
Just Joshua Aaron.
Joshua Aaron, so like the biblical names. All right, you have one of the more interesting stories I've heard. I've heard a lot of stories and really probably historic stories in terms of your mom's adoption and things like that. So when we come back, I know we're going to talk about the Trump speech, and we'll do that. We did that a lot over the first hour. And if you want to call in, weigh in with your thoughts, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. But you're going to hear a remarkable story, a remarkable redemptive story, remarkable story of God's plan when you hear the story of the lineage and history of Joshua Aaron and the amazing story of the reunion of Hannah and Micha. Who are they? And how do they tie in with my guest here? And yes, you heard him sing it, so I know you're scooting over to YouTube right now. Joshua Aaron. And just check out How Great Is Our God. Wonderful in Hebrew. We'll be right back.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, I know it's not 30 Jewish Thursday. That's tomorrow. God willing, we'll be live in Jerusalem. But right now we are live in Galilee. All right. And before we get to some further reflections on Donald Trump's speech, before we get to that, I want to sit with Joshua Aaron, worship leader, songwriter. Again, his YouTube channel, Joshua Aaron. And he told a remarkable story today. So let's go back to your mom and her brother and their parents. What happened? Holocaust, Israel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll go back to my grandmother, Ruth Epstein. She fled Nazi Germany. Actually, it's Poland now, Breslau, Poland. It was Germany before the war. And she fled here with her brothers and sisters. They were very young, in like 1940, somewhere around there. The war wasn't over yet. She gave birth to my uncle Micha in Jerusalem in 45, and my mother in January of 1948 in Haifa.
All right, so the year that Israel was birthed, your mother was born in Haifa.
Yes.
And what happened to your grandmother's family?
So her family, her brother died in the war. Tzvi Epstein, he died. He was 18 years old as a young soldier. Mm. And her husband, I'm not even sure if they were married, but my grandfather, we haven't seen him since the war. He left her alone with two small kids.
And were other family members killed in the Holocaust?
Yes. Great-grandparents.
Great-grandparents. Okay, so your uncle is born 1945.
Yep.
Your mother, 1948.
January of 1948, yeah.
Okay, what happens to them?
So because my grandmother was left alone, didn't have a husband to raise the kids. She was a single mom. She didn't think she could raise them by herself.
And you don't know why the father left?
No, we still don't know. It's a great mystery.
Wow.
It was some think he was a British soldier who left, or we don't know.
Okay. All right. So then what does your grandmother do?
She puts them up for adoption. She thinks the best thing. Israel was, it was rough then. It wasn't a state yet. Mm. So Israel became a state in May. My mom was born in January, put in the orphanage, you know, before May. So somewhere March, April. So it was rough. You know, Israel's fighting for its independence. So yeah. She thought the best thing for the kids was to put them in a real home. And an orphanage back then was like a kibbutz. It was a walled, little walled community with a guard tower. Like they were protected as well.
And was your grandmother Orthodox Jew?
She wasn't.
Okay.
She wasn't.
All right.
She was a typical secular Jew that fled Nazi Europe.
Or so they're now little children,
yeah.
Three
and a baby, yeah.
And what happens to them?
Micha was adopted, the older brother, 3 years old, was adopted into a kibbutz, secular Jewish family, which is a typical family in Israel today still.
Mm-hmm. Did he know as he was growing up that he had a sister?
Yeah, he was three, so he remembered this baby sister.
Had memories, interesting.
His whole life he'd say, where's my little sister? Where's my sister? Where's my sister?
Okay.
His whole life.
Now, what about your mother? What happened to her?
So my mom was adopted as a baby into an Orthodox couple's home who couldn't have kids. Also, similar story, fled Nazi Europe. Family died in the Holocaust, but they fled as a young couple. So my mom was adopted to an Orthodox couple's home in Haifa.
And as far as she knew, she was their one and only daughter.
They didn't tell her she was adopted.
And she didn't know she had a brother.
No.
So she was their one and only daughter.
One and only.
Okay, and where did they live?
So they lived in the Krayot in Haifa, like at the bottom. Her father owned his last name was Miller. He owned a marble factory. He had some business in Germany, and he brought his business expertise to Israel, and he cut and sold marble.
All right, and then what happened to them?
Okay, so the father died when my mom was six.
Mm.
And the adopted mother put her in the orphanage because she didn't think she could raise my mom. So my mom was left in the orphanage from 6 years old till 11.
So she's, all right, so twice now.
She thinks this is the first time.
Right, but it's happened twice, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could well be, and the story is that she was the first baby adopted in Israel.
Yes, yes. So we don't know for sure. All we know is that later on we will search the records. Somebody at the the office in Israel said, hey, you're the first record we can find, you know, on our book of an adoption.
Wow. All right. So in her mind, it's the first time being adopted, but so, it's actually her second. So 6 to 11, she's in another orphanage.
An orphanage, yep, in Haifa. Probably the same orphanage, as a matter of fact.
All right. So the biological father disappears.
Yeah.
The adoptive father dies.
Dies. Yep.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. My mom said she was so attached to him. She loved him so much. He was such a tender guy. Peretz Miller was his name. Miller.
All right. So now what happens?
So she's left in the orphanage till 11. And one day, one of the workers in the orphanage, they said, Hannah, we have good news. You're going to America. And my mom cried. She didn't want to leave. She didn't speak in English. Mm. And they just put her on a plane by herself. And she was greeted by her adopted mother, who still was her mother, but who left her in the orphanage, greeted by her in New York City.
All right, so now she grows up, and she's got what kind of upbringing now religiously?
Orthodox. My adopted grandmother met and married her new husband, Brody was his last name, on the boat to America when she left.
Okay.
and lived in an Orthodox neighborhood in Israel, and sorry, in New York City, the other holy city.
All right. And then what happens? How does she find out now that she's
all
actually
right.
adopted?
So my mom, you know, really had a hard time. She loved God. She said, I always prayed to God. She knew he existed. She said, I had a hard time seeing him in Orthodox Judaism, she used to tell me, because it was just more rote and more religion, and she didn't see a tenderness in it. So she was hired to be a chaperone for a wealthy couple's kids in the Poconos, mm-hmm. outside of New York City. And she falls in love with the groundskeeper of this Jewish summer camp. His uncle ran the camp, but he was hired to be one of the, you know, a summer worker. He was a teenager, 17 years old. My mom fell in love with him. Of course, that he's my dad.
Okay.
His name is Andy. They fell in love, and my dad's the oldest of 9 kids, so instantly she became from an only child left in an orphanage for years,
yeah.
to being having this giant family, and they were Christian Catholic.
Okay.
So it was a stark contrast of where she, you know, grew up, Orthodox,
and
Israeli.
And what did your grandmother think of Christianity?
So my grandmother was you know the soldiers in the Nazi army, you know, their belt buckle said Gott mit uns, God with us.
Yep.
So in her mind, it was all Christian.
Yep.
So when my mom married a Christian, it was the biggest offense. You know, I grew up with her spitting on the ground when we would say this name of Jesus. She'd mm-hmm. spit on the ground.
Yeah.
Because she associated it all historically with the Crusades, the pogroms, up until the Holocaust.
Yeah. So the Nazism, Christianity, Holocaust, Crusades, Inquisitions is all straight line. Right back to Jesus, right back to the New Testament, this evil religion.
Yeah, in her mind.
Yeah, exactly. That's how
it was
she
ignorance,
said.
But yeah.
That's all right, so now her daughter,
yeah.
right, is married to a Christian, Catholic. Your ancestors died rather than be baptized, and this is, you know, apostasy to join with the enemy here. So what happens?
So she kind of tries to disown my mom, and this is when my mom finds out actually that she was adopted. And I mean,
how did she find out?
She was just angry that she was marrying my dad, and she just said, "Well, you're not mine."
So the adoptive mother said, "You're not mine."
Yes,
and that's
yes.
when she found out. That so, how yeah. old was she at this point?
My mom?
Yeah,
about 20 years old.
20 years old.
Like that.
So you
yeah.
talk about trauma in
yeah,
a life,
yeah.
triple trauma here.
You know, I try to give my adoptive grandmother credit because she had a terrible life. You
yes,
know?
Yes.
So she just feels betrayed in every
understood.
Angle. So later it was really reconciled. It became so sweet to give her credit. You know, her husband dies. She moves to she
yes,
survives.
Of course.
She wasn't in the camps, but her family dies. She makes it to Israel. Her husband dies a decade later, left her with this child all alone, moves to America. Then her daughter, only child, marries the worst. It's the worst religion you can marry.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We did, and she ended up getting over it.
Yeah, because that was her one and only.
Her only, really only real close relative in the world.
All right, so she finds out she's adopted. Revelation number one. Revelation number two, she finds out she has a brother.
Okay, my mom doesn't know she even has any family members. So my mom didn't know she had any family members for decades after that.
Okay.
3 decades after that.
All right, so she, wow, unreal.
until my uncle was looking for family over Israel. He never forgot his little sister since he was three, because they couldn't hide it from him because he was three. So he remembered.
You forget a lot of things at three, but I guess something that close.
But he remembered distinctly during the war. He remembered during the war being left alone for an hour or so at a time with his baby sister. While my grandmother would go to get bread from the store and come back.
So all your mother knows is she was adopted, but she has
nothing. As a matter of fact, my grandmother was so afraid to lose her at this point. She didn't have much information, but she was afraid to tell my mom anything.
Wow.
But until my mom started snooping a little bit as my grandmother got a little older and found a paper from a distant cousin.
All right. Wait till you hear what happens right on the other side of the break right here on The Line of Fire. And hey, if you want to weigh in, if you listened to the presidential address to Congress last night, pro or con, give us a call, 866-348-7884.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. We are still here, still live in Israel. Still have the remnant of our tour group. They got to start every morning early and long day, and many of them coming to do radio. We finish at 11 o'clock at night here and have to walk back to the hotel. But if you're just tuning in, Joshua Aaron, maybe you've seen him on YouTube singing Kikadol Elohai, for great is our God. If you haven't seen it, go to his YouTube channel, Joshua Aaron, both names spelled like in the Bible. And he's telling the extraordinary story, family background, his uncle Micha born in Israel in 1945, his mother born in 1948, January 48. Then the father abandons this young family, the mother's lost family in the Holocaust, and fled here, and the kids are given up for adoption and separated, and then Joshua's mom is adopted, and then her adoptive father dies. She's given up for adoption again. She has no clue that she has any siblings. At the age of 11, after ages of 6 to 11, living on a kibbutz in Israel, that was the second time she was adopted. She's adopted by a family in America, and she's got to come over here, doesn't know English, doesn't know anybody. And here in America, at the age of 20 or thereabouts, meets a Catholic Christian man and marries him. And that causes her adoptive mother to be angry, and because all she knows of Christianity is what she saw in the Holocaust and the horrific persecution of Jewish people. That's what she knows through history. And she tells her, well, you're not my own, in anger. Of course, they reconcile subsequently. That's when she finds out she's adopted. She's around 20 years old, but she still has no idea that she has a sibling, and she doesn't find out for sure until several decades later, and it's because her uncle, Micha, living in Israel, is searching, because he knows he had a little sister. He remembers distinctly as a three-year-old comforting his little sister that just left alone during the War of Independence and gunfire and all of this, and he'd be there with his crying little sister. He remembered that. And now he's looking for his little sister. But how in the world do you connect? How do you find her? So Joshua, take it from there.
Well, he got invited to a television show in Tel Aviv called Meni Pe'er, and he was kind of like the Oprah of Israel back in 1998. And Meni will invite Israeli celebrities and then touching stories. So they invited Micha. Somebody leaked some information, say you need to have Micha onto the show. So they invited him on the show. Told his story. He survived the 6 days war, 1967, in a parachute landing with his platoon at the Kotel, the Wailing Wall. Many of his, platoon had died, so he shared a little bit about that. And then they kind of honed in about on his family. And he said, I remember this little girl, Chana. I've been looking for her. And the host of the show put a number on the screen, and it was aired all throughout Israel. And if anybody has any information, please call this number. We'd love to help Micha connect with his family. And as a matter of fact, it just aired a couple months ago here again as a rerun.
Wow.
Somebody sent me a picture about their TV here in Israel.
Wow.
So they put the phone number on the screen, and the host looks back at Micha and says a few more things. And he says, well, Micha, before you go, we just want to do one more thing for you. We have a special guest for you tonight, and her name is Chana. your little sister Chana.
No.
And my mother comes out and meets him.
How did they find this out? How did they make this connection?
They had already made the connection. The TV show had already arranged it with us to fly in. We were hiding in the back.
But how'd you find each other? I mean, how did they ultimately find your mother?
It was through, Micha had hired private detectives, and actually, they put in the system, my mom just said I was looking for something, and they put in the system, because he was already looking, it was like an instant, as soon as my mom put something in the system, we found him.
Wow.
So the surprise was he didn't know.
Wow.
And then here my mom sitting in the audience, and they come out for the first time and embrace, literally after 50 years, in Israel's Jubilee year, 1998.
Incredible.
They're separated in 1948 and reunited in 1998.
Just extraordinary. I mean, how do you describe the moment? But it's, you can watch it, right?
Yeah. Just you can Google YouTube, Chana, Micha.
It's spelled C-H.
Both C-H-C-H.
Yeah, yeah.
Reunion. Israel, that should be enough. Chana Micha reunion.
Yeah, that's how I found it. That's
okay, good,
Yeah, with the C-H.
Yeah.
So C-H-A-N-N-A-H and then M-I-C-H-A.
A. Yeah.
That'll do it. So you're the product of all this. When were you born?
I was born in 1978.
All right, so 20 years old when this happened.
Yeah.
All right, absolutely. So what did it mean to you?
For me, it was special because you go back just a little more. 1977, a year before I was born, my mom met Messiah through a Messianic rabbi named Martin Chernoff.
Uh-huh.
Came into town.
Pioneer in the Messianic Jewish movement.
Yeah. So I always say I'm a grandchild of the Chernoffs because you know, he really brought my mom to faith because my mom didn't want to have anything to do with Christianity. But when she heard about this Jewish Messiah from a Jewish perspective, it made all the sense in the world. My dad accepted the Lord. They filled with the Holy Spirit. They grew up in a really diverse home as well, with an Orthodox Jewish grandmother and a Catholic grandmother, who was also, my Catholic grandmother still goes to the charismatic meetings.
Seriously.
My dad's side.
Fascinating. So Joshua, where do you live right now?
I live in Poria, Israel, near Tiberias.
How long have you been here?
Moved almost 2 years ago back here.
Got it. And you say back here.
I lived here 8 years ago for a year.
Okay.
How many years? 2009, 2010, I lived here.
Got it.
In Haifa.
What do you see God doing in Israel these days?
In Israel, man, there's just unbelievable. You know, you read it in this partial blindness Paul refers to. It's very less partial. It's amazing how I've been coming here for 20 years. And how 20 years ago, I remember my uncle was like telling his friend in Hebrew, Mishichi, he's a believer, like it was a weird thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's like, oh, Mishichi, he's a believer. You know, the guard has been really, the people are so much more open to who we are as 20, 30,000 believers in Israel today. They're much more open to that. You know, aside from the ultra-Orthodox and those are in the government that are religious.
Yeah.
Israelis are very open, accepting of us as believers.
And what do you see as the power of music in reaching Israelis?
Music is unbelievable. I mean, it's a different language. It just opens doors that I wouldn't have expected.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? To the secular and I believe to the religious as well.
Hey, absolutely. Listen,
since we're sitting here.
Yeah.
And since this is just spontaneous radio that just happened, we're going to end with where we started. Inclusio would be the grammatical term. We're going to end where we started. And why don't you just lead us again in singing Great is our God in Hebrew.
Okay. Gadol Elohai, shiru ki gadol Elohai, kol echad yirei, ki gadol Elohai. Shem me'al kol shem, ata ra'ui le'halel, libi yashir ki gadol Elohai.
Friends, how awesome was that? We'll post it on Facebook and link to the YouTube channel and let us exalt God in Hebrew. Think this is where it's all going to come to a glorious climax.
Right here on the lake.
That's it.
I hope so.
The lost sheep of the house of Israel, welcome back their hidden Messiah. Amen. And say, Baruch haba b'shem Elohai. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. All right, we're going to transition from that to the Donald Trump speech. Stay with us.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, one more time, we are live in Israel, Galilee. And then tomorrow night, God willing, and Friday night, coming away live from Jerusalem. And since I'm here, let me just mention something to you. Then we're going to talk about Donald Trump's speech last night. And JJ, grab clip number 14. We're going to start there in a moment. But I've just got some very exciting news for you, genuinely exciting. Many of you listening are monthly supporters, torchbearers. You stand with us with at least $1 a day per month, so $30 or more per month, and so into our ministry. And you're the backbone that enables us to do so much of what we do around the world and reaching out to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and putting this very broadcast on the air every day. And as our way of sowing back into our torchbearers, we send you a new audio message every month. We give you 15% discount in our online bookstore. We give you access to our online classes, classes I've taught on video on revival and holiness and Jewish roots, and audio classes we've taught on prayer and intercession, other things. We give you access to those, and otherwise you'd be paying for those. And then we send you an insider newsletter, things that are going on, fresh announcements, special things you can partner in prayer with. So we sow back into you. But this month, for the first time ever, we put together a special package of Jewish ministry materials that we sow into you as you become a torchbearer, a monthly supporter this month. So if you're not part of our team, join us today. Go to thelineoffire.org. We have many more exclusive things we'll be doing for our torchbearers in the months ahead. Thelineoffire.org, and click on donate and then monthly support. And to sow back into you as our gift, we'll be sending you some special Jewish ministry resources as well. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Did you watch Donald Trump's speech last night? If so, what did you think? Have you been critical of Donald Trump but maybe were positively impressed last night? Have you been one that all along has believed in President Trump and you're shaking your head saying, you see, this is what I've been telling you? Or maybe one like me that you voted for him but you had concerns, you were reluctant about voting, but you voted for him and you were hoping he would step up and be presidential in a great way, and he was last night. What are your thoughts? 866-34-TRUTH. And we'll listen to a segment. In fact, we'll do it on the other side of the break. A Latino American explaining why she voted for Trump and what her feelings are about what he's doing and what he promised in his speech. Van Jones, we played in the first hour, strongly left-leaning CNN commentator. Obviously, differs with a lot of Trump's policies, but thought he really hit a home run, my words, but really praised and commended what he did and how he did it. Others said for the first time he's been presidential, or this was the beginning of his presidency. I'll tell you this, it's really simple. All he has to do is keep acting presidential and doing the right thing, and there's not much opposition. We'll talk about that when we come back as well. So you get to weigh in your thoughts on the president's speech list on 866-34-TRUTH. And for all of our new torchbearers, we have an exclusive hardcover edition of my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, the number one tool that we wrote to give to a Jewish person to show them who Jesus is, and to give to a Christian to show them who Jesus is. An episode from Think It Through, our special show shot on location in different cities in America for Jewish outreach. A special episode, Jesus Can't Be the Messiah Because, where we counter those, and audio excerpts of the special Live from Israel week. So all that we're sowing back into you as you become a torchbearer this week as we come your way live from Israel. Again, go to thelineoffire.org, thelineoffire.org. Click on donate, become a monthly supporter there. Do that today. We come back. I want you to hear from this Latino voter of Donald Trump, this Latino supporter of Donald Trump. We'll play the few when we come back. Shake the nation, change the world. Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The Bible teaches us there is no greater act of love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Ryan laid down his life for his friends, for his country, and for our freedom. And we will never forget Ryan.
There were two standing ovations last night for the slain Navy SEAL officer. And it's very moving to watch as his widow stands and she's overwhelmed and, you know, just looks up and says, I love you, to him. And then is just overwhelmed as the applause the second time just continues and continues and continues. What's like 2 minutes of sustained applause. And according to various reports, because he didn't have camera angles on everyone, there were certain Democrats, Keith Ellison, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who did not stand. Did not stand. And when you have a moment like that, when you have a speech which is a unifying speech, meant to be, obviously there were clear attacks on the previous administration and things like Obamacare and where things went, the Affordable Care Act, things that were negative, for sure, you're going to have division. And whoever the new leader is, they're going to be fixing what the old leader did. And of course, you're going to have the Democrats standing for President Obama much more than Republicans and vice versa. But there are moments basically when everybody stands because you're an American. Moments where everyone stands because you're honoring your country, because you're honoring the sacrifice of one of your heroes, of someone that gave their lives fighting against terrorism. So there are moments when you do it. There are times when you do that. And for Democrats not to stand, they are further disqualifying themselves. The man that was chosen to give the response to President Trump was, what, a 72-year-old former governor. And even his response was panned. Rachel Maddow, who's anything but a fan of Donald Trump, basically panned the Democratic response. And Anderson Cooper, again, anything but a fan of Donald Trump, spoke of times what were inspiring in the speech. So all that to say that President Trump did extremely well. Again, the words of Chris Wallace on Fox, and he's fairly sober with his speech. He said, I feel like tonight Donald Trump became the president of the United States. Obviously, didn't agree with everything, but he said this 36 years ago, Ronald Reagan reinvented the speech to the Joint Session of Congress address. He was the one who introduced the idea of having people in the gallery and creating not just a programmatic message, but a deeply emotional message. So you have the widow or two widows of slain police officers. You have the father of a slain boy. You have a young woman that wasn't doing well in school, went to a private school, and now has made it. You have the widow of the slain officer. So it adds poignancy and reality. You're not just talking about statistics. You're talking about people. And Wallace says, I think Donald Trump reinvented it again tonight, 36 years later. I thought it was by far the best speech I've ever heard Donald Trump give. It was one of the best speeches in that setting that I've heard any president give. He certainly kept faith with his base. There were two extraordinary moments. One was when he said, we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare, and you just felt a guttural roar from the Republican side of the aisle. They've been waiting 7 years, and for the first time tonight, a president said that to a session of Congress. On the other hand, he reached out. He talked about radical Islamic terrorism. That's the first time any president has ever said that in the well of the House. He reached out to Democrats. I thought it was a grace note to begin a speech talking about that this is Black History Month, condemning the attacks on Jewish community centers and cemeteries and the hate killing in Kansas. He also talked about immigration reform. He was reaching out to Democrats. You pointed out the extraordinary moment with the widow, but also the student data has been terribly disabled, or the young girl who has failed school twice. That has been terribly disabled, or the young girl who failed school twice. I want to say this right, but I feel like tonight Donald Trump became the president of the United States. That is, yes, of course, he got it 35, 38, 40 days ago when he was sworn in. But so many Democrats did not recognize it, whether they disagree or agree with him. He became the president of the United States, and everybody's going to have to accept that fact. Now, you have celebrities responding in the most vile, ugly ways, not even going to bother to even paraphrase some of the vulgarity of some of the speech, some of the responses, some of the things that were tweeted out. And all it does is further alienate people from them, make people further resentful and say, you're just some elite, wealthy person who doesn't speak for me. And then you have the DNC chair, new DNC chair, saying Trump's speech was, quote, Bannon, Steve Bannon on steroids with a smile. That's not winning strategy. That is not winning strategy. So Rosie O'Donnell, she addresses a crowd outside the White House Tuesday during what the, quote, resistance address. And so they're rain-soaked out there. Apparently, there are about 100 people, according to the report that I have in front of me. And here she's going after him. She criticizes him on foreign policy, on the stance towards race, women's rights, while urging 100 or so gathered to resist Trump and the weather through the night. That's kind of a picture right now. Look, Donald Trump has a lot to prove, for sure. He has a lot of enemies to win over. He's made a lot of mistakes that have unnecessarily alienated people. But right now, according to reports I've read, a large majority of Americans think that he's winning the war with media. Maggie Gallagher writes in the National Pulse, February 28th, so yesterday, Americans agree Trump is beating the media and Democrats. A new Rasmussen poll suggests that Frank Cannon is right. Donald Trump is winning his war with the media and the Democrats. The attempt to, quote, denormalize the Trump administration is failing. Just 29% of likely U.S. voters think it's better for the country if the Democrats oppose President Trump in every way possible. 63% say Democrats should work with President Trump instead. Strikingly, even a plurality of Democrats, so people responded to the poll, 46% to 44%, believe it's better for the country if the Democrats work with President Trump instead of opposing him across the board. Immediately after the November elections, by contrast, Democrats wanted to stand up and fight rather than work with President Trump by a 2-to-1 margin, 64% to 32%. So APP's President Frank Cannon said this after so many years of Republican leaders getting bullied by the media, it's enough to give hope to even a bitter conservative political veteran like me. So basically, the critics, doesn't mean that they shouldn't have their criticism. Doesn't mean that they shouldn't disagree. Doesn't mean that they should throw away their values, but they should wake up to the reality. They should wake up to the reality that this is the president of the United States, that he's not going anywhere, that he has tremendous momentum on his side, and that he actually has a good portion of Americans on his side. And this is a losing battle. So when Rosie O'Donnell says, this is not Russia, this is the last night. You hear what Donald Trump said to the whole world, basically, through TV and intranet, and to all of Congress, and so many Americans watching, and so many critics praising him. You have Rosie O'Donnell out in the rain. I mean, this is quite a picture, is it not? Saying, this is not Russia. To Donald Trump and his pathetic band of white privileged criminal businessmen, I would like to see them yet. I'd say to him, yet, no, sir. She added, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter and abolish it and to institute new government. That's why we're here. So that's maybe 100 people out in the rain. It is a bit of a picture right now. Look, people that differ with his policies, let them differ with his policies. People that say, well, he's yet to earn my respect, let them say that. That's fine. I respect that. People say, well, so far it's talk. Let's see what's going to happen. Or, well, he's done a few things. Let's see if he really does it. Hey, not a problem whatsoever to have questions. But this is absolute nonsense. This is sore losers getting whinier and whinier. And it's one of those times when, if they have any sense, the celebrities, the Democratic leaders, the media leaders, if they have any sense, they'll do what Van Jones did and say, hey, I still differ with Donald Trump. I'm going to oppose him on various things, but this was presidential. And if you're against him, you better wake up, because if he keeps doing this, he's here to stay. Again, I'm paraphrasing him. Rachel Maddow and others to be largely silent. Okay, if they can't praise him, at least don't just try to find something to bash. It makes you look bad. It makes you look worse. And that's what's happening right now. And a great article on stream.org by my colleague, John. And what he says is this. Summed up in the title, Trump defends Americans' real interests against, quote, reckless elites. And he says, President Trump's first speech to a joint session of Congress was many things. It was presidential, measured, and scripted, as such addresses should be. The reaction of many conservatives who had opposed him was tinged with surprise, as if they thought he didn't have it in him. He offered to work with Democrats, spoke to goals that all citizens share, denounced ethnic bigotry, honored veterans, cops, and sheriffs. There was much that will appeal to millions of Americans who didn't even vote for Trump. But there was one discordant element which flashed in the midst of the speech like a red emergency sign and ought to have deeply alarmed a significant swath of Americans, our clueless, self-congratulatory, and profoundly reckless elites. That's a critical word which Trump used advisedly. Reckless. Reckless. It is true. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, one last time, our very last time on this trip, live from Galilee. All right, so we still have how many made it to the end? 1, 2, 3, 4. I can't see all around me. Somebody count. How many are here?
4, 6, 8.
All right, we still have the holy eight, the remnant at the end here, and some have been with me each night. All right, I want to chat with one or two of our tour group guests, but before we do that, a clip I meant to play earlier, I want to get to it before the show is over. It's self-explanatory, clip number 14.
You're Latina, right?
Yes.
Did you vote for him?
Yes.
Are you first generation here?
Yes.
Where were you born?
Guatemala.
And yet you support him?
Yes.
Tell me why.
For jobs. I came here because I wanted an opportunity, not a hangout. And the problem with here is that, you know, anybody comes in, they have a kid, and they start collecting money. That's every single person I know, that's what they do.
But there are a lot of other people.
Yes,
who
there
are
is
in
a lot of
school,
yeah. I don't have any
military.
Kids, and I didn't collect. I haven't collected.
Right.
I don't know.
And so, neither have these people. They're working.
But the majority it is.
I don't believe that's true.
That
I don't
check.
Believe that's true.
No, well, go to school and ask who has the benefits. Yeah. Go into the schools. Into the schools. You ask each kid.
Do you know how many? Do you know how many white people are on welfare?
I don't care about white people. But my point is that we came here for an opportunity, not for anything else.
Ah, a little bit heated there. But look, it's interesting that as a Latina, I keep referring to her as a Latino, but it's interesting that as a Latina, as a Latin American woman, Hispanic woman, she has to defend why she voted for Donald Trump. It says everyone she knows, so as a Guatemalan, everyone she knows as an immigrant immediately went on assistance. And here you've got someone that's part of a program or a mindset ideology that's very supportive of that kind of system, arguing with it. But again, it's just her experience, but it's all enlightening. All right, we've got another guest on our trip. Give us your first name. Where are you from?
Steven, and I'm from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
All right, and you came together with your wife?
Yes.
All right, so tell us what happened when you were going through passport control.
Oh, so
and you didn't have your voice and you had laryngitis?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah, and
so
I'm still a little bit recovering from
all right,
yeah.
But it was hard for you to say anything.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we came to the foreign passport desk and, you know, we gave all three of our passports, me, my wife, and my mother-in-law. And the lady just started staring at me and was like, what's going on? You know, like just looking at me. And I didn't know what was going on. I was just excited to be in Israel. And so she asked me, so she looked at the other two passports and saw that my wife and my mother-in-law both come from Ethiopia.
Uh-huh.
And assumed.
And there are a lot of Ethiopian Jews in Israel.
Yes.
But then there are some that may be abusing the system or like anybody else comes in and out.
Exactly.
Okay. So
exactly.
There's a concern there.
So there was a concern because they thought I was also an Ethiopian and in particular an Israeli citizen.
Okay.
Abusing the system.
Got it.
And so they started asking us questions like, she's like, you're Ethiopian. And I was like, no. I'm not. And so they literally started doing a few interrogation techniques, like, for instance, speaking in Hebrew to see if we would respond to their questions in Hebrew.
Got it.
And it was a nice little delay. And we were the last ones.
And you really, you look more Ethiopian
than my mother-in-law and my wife. Yes. Right.
And you were having a hard time speaking.
Yes, I was.
But say something and you're not saying anything.
Exactly. So they thought I was faking it because, yeah.
Got it. So, yeah, but you know, the thing is with Israeli security, a lot is done based on profiling.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a policeman was telling me once, he said, if it's 2 a.m,
mm-hmm.
right, and you see a community that's largely a black community,
mm-hmm.
and you know there's a lot of drug dealing going on,
mm-hmm.
and a white guy pulls up there at 2 a.m, gets out of his car, runs up into an apartment building, comes down 10 minutes later, gets back in his car, what's your first thought? Drug deal.
Exactly.
Because it's unlikely for that guy to be there at that, you know. So, and they said, now, racial profiling is that you're going to draw a conclusion about the character of the person based on skin color, but otherwise just the circumstances, you know, okay, this doesn't look like, you know, et cetera. So
exactly.
The same way Israel security is trained to do that. They look for certain things and how you respond, if you get nervous and all that.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you got through quickly enough.
Yes.
Right. So first time in Israel.
Yes.
What would you say overall mm-hmm. has been the impact of this tour so far for you, for your wife? What would you say?
Okay. so for my wife, I'll start there. I feel like that it's like really cultivated a love in her heart for the Jewish people. You know,
did she not have it before?
So before she's, and I don't want to put her on blast on radio, but
I mean, no, she's obviously come to Israel for a reason.
Yes.
But something.
Exactly.
Right. So it sounds like she was an anti-Semite.
Exactly.
Like
exactly. But it was more so just that she never knew before too much about the Jewish people. She had more interaction with, you know, people of other races.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming here was just an eye opener for her, you know, and it continues to be as the trip goes on.
And what is it that's giving her the love for the Jewish people from what you can tell?
I think it's more, it's as we visit the different sites and as she's experiencing more and more people along the way and just even hearing the history, actually even the stories are actually what's really impacting her.
So the history, you know, the background.
The history of the background, the battles, how God has touched and come through in many different situations, many different miracles, and the foundation of this nation has kind of impacted her in a big way.
And it is so many things that are in the Bible and related to that. What about for you?
So for myself, it's actually one of our detours that we had in Tel Aviv. I don't remember the name of the place. I think it's Dugit.
Dugit.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Dugit.
Led by Avi Mizrahi.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And so he said something at the end. It's a prayer room on, you know, on a floor in Tel Aviv. And one of the things he said was at the end, he was like, okay, well, most people put their focus towards Jerusalem, but who will stand for me and pray for the Jews of Tel Aviv?
Mm.
And that like impacted
me. Over a million Jews.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that really impacted me. And I really feel like, I mean, God willing, of course, that part of my ministry will be back here in Tel Aviv.
That is awesome. And look, wherever you are in the world, it's joined together spiritually.
Amen.
Yeah, yes. It's joined together spiritually.
Exactly.
And it's essential. It's important. It's foundational. Listen, think of it like this. Out of Adam, out of the first man, came a woman.
Mm.
Every man since then has come out of a woman.
A woman,
right? So it starts with the man, then the woman, but then the men depend on the woman thereafter, right?
Exactly.
So the first believers, all Jews, goes from there to Gentile world. Mm. But now the vast majority of the church worldwide is Gentile.
Yeah.
And it's primarily the prayers of the Gentile church that are going to help rebirth the Jewish people. And it's that debt of the one depending on the other.
Exactly.
And, you know, when you're here, you're not going to hear a word that makes you anti-Palestinian. You're not going to hear things that get you hostile politically, but you're going to recognize that God's done something.
Yeah.
And it's look, we weren't here physically when Jesus rose from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't here physically when the children of Israel were delivered in the Exodus from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go to the place, like when we're standing on Mount Carmel, where Elijah actually called down fire from heaven, or immersing people in the River Jordan today, there's that sense, it really happened. It really happened right here. And he's coming back to this very country land. Hey, friend, check out the very special Jewish resource package we have if you become a torchbearer. this week. Go to thelineoffire.org. My bottom line, God's purposes for the Jewish people remain.